This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. Value Hive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.
Value Hive podcast, and I've got Thomas Bachrach on the show for the second appearance. But if you don't know who Thomas is, it's probably because Thomas was one of the OG guests on the show. He was actually the third ever guest we had on the podcast. We recorded the first episode and published it in December 23rd, 2019, which is nuts, just to think that the podcast has lasted this long. So it was more than enough time to get Thomas back on the show. Wanted to get him a bigger audience so he can talk about what he does best, investing in esoteric, off the beaten path microcap companies. And today we're going to talk about Kaspi, a new coal play in Australia, and just any other exotic ideas that Thomas is finding over the past year and a half. So Thomas, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Hey man, it's good to be back. Thanks for having me. It's been too long, dude.
I know, a lot's changed since December of 2019. The last time we had you on the podcast, there was no COVID.
I know, right? So this is, I guess me coming on this podcast is a bad omen for general society. So yeah, hopefully things end better than last time. Crazy year, obviously. Not a bad year investing wise, but it was certainly a wild year in every other normal human respect. So
yeah, well, talk to us about what your year was like, year and a half was like since you've been on the show. How's the fund doing? What have you, what's worked for you this last year and a half in terms of investments? Maybe talk about some of the mistakes you've made as well.
Yeah, so obviously, there was like a meme on Twitter at some point where it was like a hedge fund manager, and it was like, this was like back in like April of last year. And it was like, when you realize that your life is actually called quarantine, it was basically like, I can't say it, COVID didn't have a massive impact, obviously, on my day to day, because I already work from home, and, it didn't affect my ability to go out and look for new businesses. We had kind of some cash to deploy. And so it ended up kind of being a little bit of an opportunity to get that deployed. There were some good buying opportunities in the first half of last year. That was what the year was, man. I mean, it was sit down, look for ideas, do your research, and then go sit around a fire pit at night. I mean, that was a big chunk of the idea. The hiccups, of course, is if you have young kids, which I do, those periods of time where they were out of school and they were home got very interesting. Had to definitely adjust the process for that. But all things considered, it was a good year. Volatility in the market is not a bad thing for value investors. So
that's awesome. Now talk about your overall strategy at PFH Capital. Cause again, this is the first time we had you on. I think we had 200 or 300 people listen to the episode, and knock on wood, we've had quite a few more people listen in. So for those that don't know PFH, which is the fund you run, what's the strategy there?
Yeah, so I mean, it's essentially summed up as compete with as few smart peer managers as possible. My goal in life isn't to be the smartest guy in the room, it's to be in the room that's kind of empty. There's a low competitive bar. And we do that kind of two ways. One, very small asset size, that allows you to invest in illiquid names the big guys can't get into. And two, I seek broad international access, into about 100 markets right now. And what that does is that gives me access to markets that fellow kind of microcap funds are either unable or even unwilling to access. And, you know, doing so in theory, you know, improves the odds we're going to find good to great businesses for irrationally cheap valuations, because, you know, we're fishing ponds without a lot of fishermen, you know, essentially. So, but, you know, just to go back to an analogy I think I used the first time with you.
Yep. No, it's perfect. And, you know, since I've discovered, you know, your letters and your work, it was really, you know, you that turned me on specifically to Poland, which is a place I know you and I both really, really like trying to find ideas. I want to shift before we kind of dive into some of the newest companies that you're looking at. Any mistakes that you may have made during the past, you know, year and a half or so investing wise that you're either trying to work on now or you've conquered those mistakes, and then what you did to rectify those?
You know, it's, you know, it's interesting, right? As you're developing as an investor, you're changing, you're evolving a lot, you know, hopefully for the better, right? And, you know, that generates a bit more portfolio turnover than is optimal. I kind of hit a point in the last few years where I've been real stable. I don't have really significant turnover these days. It's, you know, I can't say that the strategy's been changing much or anything, and, you know, or that I've, you know, and maybe that's wisdom experience. Maybe I've just fallen into a trap of intellectual laziness. In terms of like, you know, in terms of kind of mistakes over the past year, you know, I actually followed COVID really closely starting in January 2020. And I felt with reasonably high conviction it was being underestimated risk-wise. And yet somehow it really never occurred to me to more, I guess, mindfully hedge the portfolio against the risk. You know, there was no Ackman-esque brilliant hedging moment at PFH Capital. You know, we, you know, stick to, you know, strong businesses, relatively unlevered names, and had some cash. So did well. But probably should have done better. And you know, if we're talking mistakes, I should also probably disclose I bought an oil business at, I think, top oil prices in the beginning of February 2020, which,
nice.
Yeah. Which, you know, again, you know, the business was unlevered. It was a low cost producer. It's recovered price wise and the business is doing well. So it ended up okay. But,
yeah,
you know, I could have bought that thing for 50% cheaper if I waited a month or two. You know, those are kind of the mistakes from the past year. And they're all mistakes I can live with. You know, earlier in my investing career, I was making bigger mistakes because, you know, I think I had a more reckless approach. And, you know, the way I'm set up right now as a value investor for margin of safety is that, you know, I know I'm going to make mistakes, and just, you know, how much are they going to hurt me? And,
right,
you know, they didn't really hurt me last year in a significant way. And that's kind of the idea. And hopefully that'll continue going forward.
So then a question I've got for you with regards to the hedging, you know, saying that you saw, or with a decent probability that the COVID risks weren't necessarily embedded fully in kind of what you were seeing here and following it closely. What was the sticking point, whether it was like mentally or psychologically, that allowed or that prohibited you from putting on some sort of hedge or some sort of broad market short?
So, yeah, I'd kind of say, you know, I could use the oil business, you know, as a, it's probably like a pretty good example of this. Like, you know, there was a failure to connect what I was, you know, observing in one frame, which is, hey, this thing's in China, it's spreading to Italy, it's like, you know, seems to be worse than the news that we're seeing, because right, obviously the news out of China can be a little bit questionable and controlled at times, shall I say?
And shall you say?
Shall I say? And the there was a failure to connect what I was observing in that frame of reference to another, which is I was looking at an oil business. And you know, I think, you know, I take a very long-term approach to investing, and I stand by that. I think it's the right way to do it. And I think I saw a business that at its price was underpriced for what it should produce in the future. But, you know, there's probably some room for balance in there to say, hey, like, you know, we have a major event unfolding and, you know, hey, what's another month or two of due diligence and patience, you know, just to wait and see how it goes. I don't know. I mean, if I had it over again, would I have done it differently? I mean, with the facts as I know them now, yes, but you know, of course it's easy, obviously, to Monday morning quarterback yourself. You know, one of the things about COVID that was, I saw the curve flattening stuff coming. I for sure felt, I don't know when it was there, but probably very early in February, I was like, okay, well, you know, the kids are going to be out of school for a while and this and that. And I had kind of early insight, I think, into that. But, you know, I think also in my mind, it was, hey, you know, we're going to be locked down for like 6 to 8 weeks, about pass through, the thing's going to burn out in the summer. Everyone's going to more or less get back to normal. There'll be a second wave, as there always are, to these respiratory things in the winter. But I saw them as kind of two short-term bumps, not an extended year and a half.
Right.
You know, complete, you know, really a psychological and cultural change. And so I still underestimated it. Once we were kind of at rock bottom, while there were a lot of interesting businesses to buy, I could not have predicted that the reaction was going to be kind of the speculative bubble we've seen since. It kind of makes sense in retrospect. You know, I think the government policy was very, very, very serious about spitting money out in the system.
Yep.
You know, and you know, we'll see how that works out long term, but you know, it was so even though I kind of saw it as a risk, I don't think I saw it as what it truly became. And so even if I had made optimal decisions at the moment, you know, it still would have surprised me. So you know, it kind of sums up probably the COVID piece there, but you know, it was a good year overall. And you know, and yeah, like we said, like, you know, value investor, it was volatile. Things were getting disrupted. Things were getting thrown around. And that's, you know, we should like that from a narrow investing standpoint, maybe not from all the other human standpoints, but from the investing standpoint. So.
Yeah. So you've got a pretty eclectic portfolio. You've got names in a bunch of different countries, which I assume, you know, you kind of track what's going on there from a geopolitical spectrum. What countries in your book, at least, were getting hit hardest by COVID? Because I think a lot of people, they only looked at what was happening in the US and they only looked at what was happening to US companies. But were you seeing anything fascinating, maybe any divergences between countries where some businesses were holding up better than others?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. It's, you know, obviously I had an oil business, which obviously, you know, just the price just simply went way down. They were actually able to break even, even at the bottom, because they're in Oman and their, you know, incremental cost, not including the capital side of it, is like $10 a barrel, you know, and it's 20, maybe 24 bucks, including all the capital you have to spend to keep production balanced and keep your reserves stable. So, you know, I mean, they have profit share things and all that. So, you know, like they're not breaking even necessarily at 24, but pretty close to that. So they, you know, obviously that was one that, you know, took a hit and took a beating, but I, you know, most of the other businesses I was in, you know, didn't really get overly hit. You know, I had a small position in Armanino Foods, for example. Actually, they did get hit because they sold in the restaurants. That was such a tiny position. That was actually in the US that it didn't really matter that much. You know, in terms of countries that got hit, you know, obviously, you know, I don't invest in China, and that was where all the initial impact was. You know, moved in Italy. I don't invest there. by the time it was through Italy, it was all over Europe and
yeah,
it was into the US. And at that point, you know, really it wasn't a matter as so much as how is the country doing? It's how is your company's industry doing? Mm-hmm. So, you know, some thrived. I mean, you know, we've talked about live chat a bunch in Poland. Like COVID was a boom to, you know, COVID was a boon to them. I mean, that was, that was, it was objectively, you know, good for them. You know, if you owned an airline or an airline leasing company or something, and I bought some, you know, Spirit Airline calls, you know, kind of at the bottom, as a tactical thing, but, I didn't own any of that going in. You know, it was very different. So, you know, every country I've had, I mean, you know, I'm investing in Egypt these days. Like they had a little wave. I've been kind of shocked how little they've been hit. Poland's gotten hit plenty. Does it impact Poland that much? Like from an investor standpoint, not really. It's a bunch of like IT businesses and stuff. Right. So, you know, they can all work from home and their business is booming. So, you know, it's, there's no brilliant answer I can give you where I said, hey, this one country killed me. This country did great. You know, it truly became global. So,
Well, I mean, that's kind of how I thought it would be. And it's just fascinating too. I didn't even think about it the way you framed like Poland, where you've got a lot of technology, work from home already businesses. So those types of companies would be apt to, you know, make adjustments way quicker than say, you know, industrials or something where you've got to be in a factory 24/7. One question I do have, and this is something that I just wrestle with all the time. And, you know, from one global investor to another, you have investors like Li Lu and Charlie Munger talk very bullish about China. And for the longest time, I always go back and forth. I'm like, you know, I love Li Lu. Charlie Munger, you know, very well respected. It's two smart guys, both saying, you know, China, bullish China. But for, you know, other reasons, I just can't wrap my head around investing in some of these businesses. Like, I just don't have the confidence as I do other countries. Have you found that to be kind of the case for you? Because I know you invest, you know, like you said, in Egypt, you invest in all these, you know, crazy markets, and yet you still stay away from China. So, you know, is it something where you've tried to understand it because it is becoming kind of nomenclature within the, you know, Li Lu Munger community, or is it something more?
So I really don't touch China. I do have an investment in Hong Kong right now. I also owned a bond in Hong Kong, which should be repaid, fingers crossed, here any day now. But I really don't trust, I really don't touch mainland China. I think there's a serious learning curve getting, adept in that market. And I think that country is full of incredibly smart, engaged investors. And I don't necessarily feel a lot of like advantage going in there, absent me saying, hey, I'm gonna move to China and live there for 5 years. On top of that, like, you know, the geopolitical situation is just, you know, I don't think this China US rivalry is about to simmer down. You know, if anything, it could be on the verge of an escalation with, you know, China kind of intent on making moves on Taiwan. I'm of course bullish and think China's got, you know, a future as a whole. On another sense, you know, I always question the stability of a political system that seems hyper dependent on capital investment, kind of generated economic growth. You know, if that growth slows down, do people start to care more about their personal freedoms or not? I don't know. You know, that's up to the Chinese, but like I wonder about stability of the political system over the long run. But on top of all that too, I don't feel as a foreign or more specifically American investor going in there that that I am going to be able to suss out fraud well enough. And I think that I just think the political situation between our countries is such that being an American investor with assets on the ground in China at some point is going to leave you very, very exposed. Maybe already has. And I just kind of, so, you know, the combination of all those factors, I just kind of don't have much interest. I prefer markets, you know, one of the things that made Egypt interesting to me, besides the fact, you know, I lived there for 5 years and very familiar, that was obviously a big piece of it, is that it's a country where there aren't that many people picking through its stock market. And so I, you know, including domestically, and so I knew I could kind of go through there relatively limited competition. I just can't say that about, the Chinese market. It's not hidden. I am interested in other countries around there. South Korea is one that I think has some interesting, valuation levels. Malaysia is one that is probably of interest to me, but I can't say I've dove into it too much yet.
There's some really good ideas in Malaysia that I can send you. I spent like a month writing 3 or 4 different companies. A lot of agriculture, like palm olive stuff, palm oils, commodities, but super cheap producers.
Ship them over, man. I am preparing for, one of the staples for PFH Capital is, periodically find a country that is trading cheap but seems to have a lot of good businesses in it, and I got to be comfortable with the geopolitical situation in that country. That rules out a lot of countries, if I'm being honest. And then basically say, all right, well, let's take the whole market, let's filter out the ones that we definitely don't have interest in, and let's just go through them all. So that is a periodic mission. It becomes a multi-month endeavor. If I'm being honest, I haven't really truly done that yet this year in any markets to like the extent that I was planning, because I've kind of continued to end up with a lot of good ideas on my plate. And it's not like there's always been one or two things where I'm like, okay, as soon as I'm done going through this idea, I'm gonna do that dive.
That is so true.
You know, and that's the organic nature of like investing. Like you can't, it's good to have a process, I guess, in theory, but so much of it is just kind of organically going from one idea to the next. I mean, there are times where I'm in an idea where it's like, someone's like, oh, where do you find this idea? I'm like, I can't even remember. I don't even know. I'm like 3 weeks into looking at this thing and I can't remember what the hell got me there. If it was someone mentioned it. it's kind of a, that's the nature of investing, though. It's part of what makes it a fun career, to be honest. So
then, in terms of, this is just kind of a tangent question before we dive into, the ideas section. When you go to siphon out your research process, or schedule your research, is it okay, I'm gonna run a screen, or I'm gonna look through the Egypt stock market, this month, and then next month I'm gonna go to New Zealand, and then next month I'm gonna go to Hong Kong? Or is it a little bit more, as you said, organic?
It's much more organic. Yeah, I mean, truly, with Egypt, just use Egypt as an example. There's like 250 listed, companies there, and essentially, what I do with Egypt is I said, all right, well, let's go through them. Let's basically block out these 50 black box state-owned companies that like have terrible historic return on equity and are basically uninvestable. And then you say, okay, well, these ones are valued insanely and I'm never going to get to a level of conviction that supports me pay that price. But before you know, you end up with 100 some companies, and you just start going through them one by one. You kind of try to prioritize them by what looks the most interesting at first. But then you just start going through them. And sometimes I spend less than 5 minutes on something, and sometimes you end up spending a month and a half. So it's, but you just start going through it. And it's kind of, it's a little bit organic. When I start on a new country, I don't know for sure. Am I going to be doing this for a month and then go on to something different? Cause there just wasn't anything there that really grabbed me.
Yeah.
Or is this going to become a 6, 7, 8, 12 month obsession, you know? And in the case of countries like Poland and Egypt, you know, the fact is like, you know, those are countries I scan through a lot and I'm going to go back to that. Well, you know, I mean, it's, you know, periodically, like, yeah, like every, I don't know if it's every couple of years or whatever, I'm going to rifle through them again. Cause, you know, things change, things pop up. And so, you know, I suspect at some point, there's probably going to be about 10 countries that I've, you know, if you're talking to 50-year-old me, there's probably 10 countries I've gotten really, really, really comfortable with, mm-hmm. have lots of local investor contacts, have, you know, just have built that all out. And I'm essentially rotating between them over time based on which ones look the cheapest. And, you know, that's probably where it'll end up long term. But it's anytime I try to overly plan it and say, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do exactly this, and I'm going to do exactly this, it doesn't work out that way because in the end of the day, when ideas fall on your desk or things that you stumble into that look really, really good, you're not going to just push them to the side and say, well, no, this is what I was going to do. I was going to tick A, B, C, D, and then, you know, mm-hmm. so it's a balancing act. So
are there any countries over the last year that you've just started looking at that are, you know, new to your research process?
So new countries, I have stuck my toes in a couple different ones. I've begun to stick my toe in India a bit, begun to stick my toe in the South, you know, South Korea a bit more. I got a business there in particular, that if I could ever get management to, you know, emerge and, you know, answer a call or an email or whatever, it looks incredibly interesting. But in the end of the day, it's really the two countries that I've probably done the deepest dives on in the last year and a half have been Poland and Egypt. And there's a third country that's going to pop up sometime in these next few months that I'm going to go nuts on for the rest of the year. And they're still competing. You know, who knows, man? It might be Malaysia's in the back of my mind. So maybe you'll be the one that, you know, pushes me down that road.
The one company, let me look it up. It's it's My EG Services. Ticker is MYEG. I don't own it personally, but it was one of the strongest businesses I've seen in Malaysia. They basically handle all of the back end government service project, like infrastructure. So you need to pay tolls, you need to pay taxes, you need to get a license, you need to get a permit, you go through MYEG, and the Malaysian government, you know, uses them to do all of those processes. Super, super sticky business. Founder still owns a good amount, I believe, 54% profit margins. It's got, what is it now? Got like a 1% dividend, trading 24 times current earnings. That's a really good business. And I found that business in the same vein as Andrew Rosenblum. And he had, it was actually a Hong Kong company that specialized in like airport infrastructure, back-end infrastructure and logistics. So just a super sticky business. So that one I'll send you the write-up for, because I think it's a great, great one to start with.
No, definitely. Yeah, send it over. Now, is all their revenue pretty much from the Malaysian government then, or is it?
So most of it is, but I guess, you know, part of the bull thesis is that they're expanding into Indonesia and trying to get those neighboring countries to start adopting those technologies. I think one issue that they're going to have is whenever you give that much control over a government's back-end processes to some country that's not internal, or to some business that's not, you know, an internal business to your nation state, there's going to be some high sticking points. So, you know, if Indonesia and Malaysia ever got into a tiff and, you know, a Malaysian company is running Indonesia's government backend software, that could be an issue.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. So, you know, it's, yeah, you got that it's a interesting form of geopolitical concentration risk.
But
yeah, that's interesting. Business. Yeah. Send it over, man. There's no business from this planet, or really actually the solar system, that you could send me that you can get me to look at. So, yeah. You know, the more obscure, the better, as you know.
Well, I mean, look, we've got confirmed UFOs now, so maybe there is an exchange somewhere else in the solar system.
That's exciting, man. That's we got to keep our eyes on that. There might be some quirky, Martian investment opportunities or something here. So
I don't know how that's not frontline news every single day. Like, honestly,
you know, it's funny. I've been so wrapped up in researching a couple things recently that I'm like barely informed. You know, when you're like really deep into research and some news event happens and you're like, I'm behind on this thing. So like, I just keep on hearing people tell me that there's like UFOs flying around, and I'm like, this would have made its way to me if this is real. I have to spend a little more time Googling it. Yep. So, I mean, you know, honestly, after 2020, I kind of feel like, you know, people are at a point where it's like, oh yeah, there's an alien flying around outside, and people just kind of go on with their day. You know, we're a bit more resilient probably as a society now. So they're, you know, it's, yep. As long as you can go to a restaurant and grab a beer at a bar, I think people are probably okay with aliens. So.
I love it. Let's switch now to the idea portion of this. So we're going to talk about Caspi and Allegiance Coal. So Caspi, you actually weren't the only person to shoot this idea over to me. We had someone in our collective DM me and said, hey, you should take a look at Caspi. It's got your name written all over it. And it really does. And it's one of those names that I'm going to go through at some point once I finish, you know, the research that's in front of me. But let's kind of get your take on it. So first, where did this idea come from for you? How did you find it? And then kind of walk us through the thesis that you've seen, and maybe the thesis that you're painting.
So, you know, I got the idea from it's Alex Eliason. You know, he's not a guy I've ever spoken with before. I don't know who sent me this, but it's Alex Eliason. His last name is spelled E-L-I-A. S-S-O-N. So he has a Substack, a bunch of followers, and he put the idea out there. You know, the business kind of seemed a little bit too good to be true. But, you know, so I kind of blocked out his write-up and really kind of tried to do my own work on it. And, you know, there's a lot of substance there. It's a pretty remarkable business. But that's where it came from. Both these ideas I'm going to talk to you about today, came from other people, and, you know, you do your own work and you figure it out. It's, I like to make sure I'm driving enough things that I'm finding on my own and finding from other people. But, but hey, if the idea is good, go with it. Yep. So you want me to walk you through the kind of thesis a bit on that one?
Yeah. Kind of, you know, as best you can, soup to nuts, someone that knows the company's name, but hasn't, you know, opened up the pitch deck yet.
Yeah. So basically, so Caspi, it's KSPI in the London Exchange. They just IPO'd, around a quarter of their shares on the London Exchange last year. So it's the dominant payments marketplace and fintech ecosystem in Kazakhstan. So basically half the country is a monthly active user of what they call their super app. You know, that number's, you know, if you exclude kids under 14 from the denominator, which is probably more fair since, you know, they're probably not using this app directly. You know, it's more like 2/3 of the country's on it. And that app is essentially like, if you just cram Chase Bank, Amazon, and like MasterCard, Visa into like a single app. You know, there's really no parallel in the US for something like this. Right. China has closer parallels with you know, things like, you know, WeChat and, you know, Alibaba, Alipay, all that. But the core bull thesis is simple. They've built an incredible ecosystem. They're run by a maniacal, hyper-competitive CEO who, you know, owns a huge chunk of the business. And while competitors kind of may chip away at the edges of their ecosystem, taking on the whole thing would be really difficult. Basically from Kaspi's point of view, you know, if they do a good job making sure all their stakeholders, consumers, merchants, and also the government derive value from that ecosystem, then it'll be very hard to break up. And they're hyper-focused on that. And I'm going to throw out some numbers here because, I mean, that's a big part of the thesis. You know, so the business is only priced a bit over 15 times estimated earnings for this year. It might be closer
to 15 or 50.
15.
Okay. Wow.
So 15 times. It might be closer to 16 or 17. You know, and I don't know what the stock's done the last couple of days, but yeah, it's called 15. It makes case sound better, right? So we'll go. And by the way, that's their guided 2021 earnings. They are every indication off the first quarter this year is they're ahead of schedule. I'm not going to say they're going to beat them. Yeah, it's still too early, but they're doing well, let's say. So this is a business that's tripled earnings per share in the last 3 years. You know, they're running at a return on equity over 80%. They're paying a 3% dividend yield, which, you know, always makes me laugh when these compounders are like sending us back capital. It's a different from the Silicon Valley model where you send them capital. That's the only direction it flows. And their growth metrics are just, you know, they're crazy. Throw a couple at you. The percent of total, not just e-commerce, the percent of total Kazakhstan retail trade that flows through their marketplace, their Amazon-style marketplace segment. It's gone from 3% in 2017 to 11% in the most recent quarter. The share of cashless transactions that flow through their payments segment grew from 13% in 2017 to 69% this past quarter. One of the things that's kind of interesting about them is those trends preceded COVID. This isn't just like a COVID thing. Like the payment share had already got to 61% in 2019. So basically between 2017 and 2019, prior to COVID, they just really destroyed Visa and MasterCard. I mean, they were the players in what was a very small at the time, cashless kind of economy. Yep. And they just took all the growth. Yeah. That's the basic bull thesis is like, holy crap, look how fast these guys are growing. They're 15 times earnings and they have room to continue growing. So that's the basic bull pitch on them.
So I've got one question I have right off the bat is region concentration. So is it only in Kazakhstan right now? And are they trying to penetrate other markets or what's the take there?
So right now the business is truly 100% more or less dependent on Kazakhstan right now. Now they have acquired three different kind of e-commerce businesses. They're all leading in their various segments, whether it's, auto sales or this or that or blah, blah, blah. They're all leading in their various segments, but it's a drop in a bucket right now for them in Azerbaijan. So the answer is yes, they are trying to expand. And in an ideal world, they are going to be, you know, the dominant super app in Central Asia, the Caucasus, and maybe even a couple of countries like Ukraine. I know that they have their eye on it, as I understand. But these are kind of, you know, they're going to continue to kind of try to build these things out long term. And it's so there's explosive upside if they do that. There's 18 million people in Kazakhstan. Uzbekistan next door is 33 million. Ukraine's 44 million. Ukraine's still very cash based. So that's a super opportunity there, even though it's a little bit outside their core region. The CEO of Kaspi's from Georgia. That's 11 million people. Azerbaijan, the answer that they've entered already. That's 10 million people. So they are looking to expand. If that happens, this thing is worth many, 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 many times, I think, what the current price is. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's no guarantee they're going to be successful outside. And so, you know, for me, my approach has been to try to get comfortable with where they can continue to go within Kazakhstan and kind of say, hey, I have some free optionality upside. And as they start to prove it, I'll start giving them more credit to an evaluation. Mm-hmm. That's been kind of what it is. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, one of the things too, that makes it so interesting, right, is, you know, the region I'm describing, which is, you know, the Caucasus, not including a Russian known part, Central Asia, you know, really the stands, that is. And, you know, if they can tack in Ukraine, that, you know, and maybe a couple other former Soviet states, you know, that'd be awesome. You know, we're talking like 1% of the global population, which, you know, some people go, oh, well, their total adjustable market's only 1%. And to me, I'm like, well, no, that's still huge relative to where they are right now, which is what matters, because we're paying them on current earnings, and they're, you know, 0.1% of a global population or whatever. I pulled a number out of my butt. That's probably off by a reasonable amount, but it's tiny, right? And they're, you know, and so, yeah, if they can go after 1% of the world, that's still huge growth for them. And what's really interesting about it is this is a very small percentage of the world's population in these regions. These regions are very complex. They're a little bit fraught politically. If you follow them, some countries have done very well. Some have, you know, kind of had the constant instability threats. These aren't countries that the big international players are either knowledgeable enough to enter and compete, which is why some of them have, you know, a lot of them have been reaching out to Kaspi trying to partner, and Kaspi's kind of essentially said back to them, like, well, you know, what are you going to bring to the table? And they can't answer what they're going to bring, because usually what they're going to bring to the table is they're like, here, we'll give you a bunch of money. Kaspi's like, we don't need money. We're making like massive margins. We have too much cash. We're sending it back to shareholders. Yep. So what are you going to bring? And you have like technical know-how, and they don't have a good answer. So it's kind of this idea that they could build this niche kind of in that little 1% of the world, you know, I mean, the returns on capital you can produce if they can do that are phenomenal. But like I said, you got to be careful. They got to prove that first. Look, if there's someone who's going to do it in that region, I think it's them. But you also might just end up with a Kaspi of Uzbekistan and a Kaspi of Ukraine, and rather than one that's overlapping them all, you know. So, So I don't know if that answers that question, but
no, it does. And the only thing that I'm interested in is, you know, as they start getting closer to Ukraine, obviously you're getting, you know, you're kind of knocking on Russia's doorstep in terms of maybe where Russian companies want to go. And, you know, two businesses that I see in Russia that I think could compete, and again, maybe they don't even want to, you know, you've got Sberbank, which could do something in the payments fintech platform. And then you've also got Yandex, which is, you know, pretty much Russia's Google for those that aren't familiar. Again, I don't know if Yandex wants to do something like that, but that's a company that generates enough cash where if they wanted to, they could probably swing together something like a super app and try to compete. Have you seen any inclinations that might be the case from there, or do you think that that's not even a you know, remote player in this industry going forward?
So actually, it's funny, the major outside investor in Kaspi originally, I believe, is also one of the major investors in Yandex.
That's funny.
So it's a big PE firm. That, you know, that specialized in that region, and whose head, by the way, was arrested. Guy got in a political spat with another guy in Russia and got completely without evidence tossed in jail and then released. And so it's these things, the rivalries, all the complexities, you know, they're so interesting. Yeah. You know, I within Kazakhstan, You know, it's funny, Kazakhstan's kind of positioned themselves geopolitically, and these are their words, not mine, as the Asian Geneva is okay. Kind of how they do it. It's actually really interesting. I mean, you think about it, right? They're in between Russia and China. Neither China nor Russia really want that other big power to develop influence. So it actually creates an opportunity for kind of Kazakhstan to, in a sense, maintain adequate independence from both. And they've also managed to kind of have good relations with the EU and US. And so they've done a good job kind of being non-confrontational and kind of, you know, a little Switzerland-esque kind of island in that region. So I think they're well positioned. To me, for a Russian company to try to come in and go after their entire ecosystem would be really difficult. There's not going to be political pressure to do that. They would have to truly compete their way in. I think it'd be really tough for them to do that. Now, what can happen, you know, within Kazakhstan, for example, is really the number two player in marketplace right now is Wildberries, which is a Russian firm. If you look at it,
are they publicly traded? You said Wildberries.
Yeah. And if you look at it, I don't know. I don't think they're publicly traded. Maybe they are. I couldn't find them,
but I could be looking wrong.
I don't think so, but actually, I don't know. Actually, they're a Russian company. I haven't done any real serious work on a Russian market, but right now, if you look at the landscape and marketplace, like Wildberries has 10% share, Alibaba has 10% share, and then basically in e-commerce, you know, Kaspi controls almost all the rest of it. I mean, they're probably in the 60s, percent for e-commerce share. It's crazy. I don't have those numbers in front of me right now, so don't quote me. But they're huge. They're number one player by multiples. Now, the dynamics of what's going on is Alibaba's really falling off, whereas Wildberries is really kind of growing at the same rate as Kaspi. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily capturing market share from Kaspi yet. Over time, I suspect they would, but in the end of the day, you know, it's kind of like, what are we talking about here? Well, yeah, it's kind of good for Kaspi to get a little bit of a number two player in there. I mean, you know, at a certain point, one of the biggest risks is you're like, hey, they're doing too well. They're out competing everybody. They're destroying everybody. They're going to be face monopoly type pressures. Yeah, it's almost a relief to see some competitors breaking in there. Right now, Wildberries would be the one maybe to become a strong number two in marketplace. But again, like that's the marketplace segment, you know, Kaspi's value is the ecosystem. You know, Kaspi's a bank with, you know, an Amazon and an Alipay attached, right?
Crazy.
If they want to beat you as a marketplace competitor, they can underprice you and they can make their money up in their other segments. If they're receiving pressure over the fees they charge merchants on payments, which they shouldn't because they charge 95 basis points and, Visa, MasterCard are still in that 2.5% to 3% zone. They could lower those and make money elsewhere. I mean, at the end of the day, they could basically use payments as marketplace, and they're not doing this. They're making big margins here, but they could basically use those as, you know, close to break even and just essentially own every single cheap retail deposit in Kazakhstan where there are high interest rates. So you essentially take a bunch of 0% deposits. And I mean, the net interest margin would be out of control. In reality, they're going to seek the balance across the segments. And there's an adaptive nature. If they're feeling pressure here, they can move over here. If they're feeling pressure here, they can move over here. I don't see anyone in Russia that's going to come in and mess with their ecosystem there. How's that going to play out in Azerbaijan? How's that going to play out in Ukraine? I don't know at this point. Going to have to kind of watch how those things unfold. And because I don't know, you just have to be really, really careful what you're underwriting in terms of long-term growth. I think anyone has too strong an opinion on where those places, how those are going to happen 5 years down the road is probably a little overconfident. And, that's why I'm a value investor. I don't like to have to try to do this type of, you know, insane high level gymnastics, you know, my investments. So,
yeah. But I mean, look, you're paying what, 15 times, you know, current earnings for this business. So it's not like you're paying, I mean, that's 15 times like normalized earnings, right. Next 12 months normalized earnings. So, you know, and then like you said, you've got from Q1 of 2020 to Q1 of 2021, almost 50% of their, of their net income now is from their payments and marketplace as opposed to their, you know, fintech business, which I think fintech, if you're just like a de facto bank, I think that by default is a lower multiple business, at least on a, you know, go forward run rate business. But if you're talking about payments and marketplace, then I think you can easily re-rate to 25, 30, 35 times earnings. And you know, is the only reason why this company is trading at 15 is because they're in Kazakhstan and they're listed on the LSE, and you know, it's not as easy for US investors just to kind of do due diligence or even invest there because of certain mandates. Because 15 times earnings seems at this point like cheap enough just to buy it and just kind of forget it.
Yeah, and that's I'd give a couple reasons kind of why it's probably still priced, I think, a little bit too cheap. And I would, and kind of these would be, I guess, also some of the bear pitch points. It's hard to make a strong bear pitch, I guess, with their current price. Reason number one is they were, you know, they IPO'd in London, and so it is accessible to people now, right? They IPO'd in London last October 2020. And I think sometimes it takes these stories time to get out. And I think we're in the process of the story getting out. I mean, the fact is that they're still up. They've still more than doubled since their IPO. So the story is getting traction. I just think it has quite a bit longer to run. They are, and by the way, since the IPO, the growth has still been torrential. So it's not all just like the earnings multiples going up. It's like the base itself is just going up a lot. Obviously, I think the fact that they are based in Kazakhstan would dissuade a certain number of investors. There are a lot of people, obviously, me and you, you know, are probably almost irrationally over-attracted to the fact that it's in Kazakhstan, right? But
yeah. That's why I'm
attracted. The other people are like the opposite extreme, right? And look, duly noted, you know what I mean? There's legitimate geopolitical risk in Central Asia as a whole. I'd argue Kazakhstan's actually been quite stable politically. They just had their second leader take hold since 1991. Their economic growth has been good. Like I feel pretty good about that country, but look, it's Central Asia. There's risk there. And I think the takeaway is don't bet the farm on anything that's in Kazakhstan, right? That's a position size issue and maybe a diversification, not to be over concentrated in any one market. I do think the Kazakhstan stuff plays a role. I think the fact that, like I said, recently IPO'd and the awareness is still coming into play is playing a role. Another point people could make is, that there's just not that much room left to grow within Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. And so the thesis becomes dependent on them expanding outside, which is to be determined. And very fair point. But, you know, again, we're talking 50 times earnings, not sales. You know, there's more than enough room for them to grow inside Kazakhstan this next decade. And more than justify their valuation. And if they start hitting outside the country, that's where the returns get crazy. Mm-hmm. Are they going to do that or not? I don't know. I don't have that strong of an opinion. I just know it's a potential kind of free upside in my mind. And by the way, in Kazakhstan, I mean, think about it, right? Like, think about how hard it is to compete there. I mean, this is like the eighth or ninth largest country in the world in terms of landmass. And they have 18 million people. Do people like really want to fight into that market to like compete them? I mean, why would, Amazon, Alibaba, all that, why would they expend a bunch of resources trying to compete there? So So the home base is well protected and we get that free mm-hmm. upside growth. So,
yeah,
but you know, it's a fair point. And you know, so,
I mean, I think, look, the other thing too is, you know, they're switching to the fact that most of their revenues and net income eventually will come from the payments in the marketplace, which is going to be higher margin. They'll have way more free cash available. So even if they stay in Kazakhstan for a bit longer than you expect, I mean, who's to say that they won't issue special one-time dividends, do share buybacks, and then just, you know, milk the cow and just dominate their region, generate gobs of cash, and, you know, just patiently wait until they can build a good enough product to go to other nations like Ukraine or something like a Caspi Ukraine, or, you know, try to figure that out. Because I think if they can find a way to almost, you know, white label it for a specific country, I think that could be really exciting. So, you know, like Caspi Ukraine, where it's, you know, fully Ukraine's thing. And it's almost like, you know, just this little one-off, like spin-off segment of the business. And it's almost independently run, unique to Ukraine's demographic. If they could generate enough cash to just kind of throw out bets like that, again, you're not paying for those extra bets at the current price.
Right. Right. And it is tricky doing this, right? And I think they're going to move a little slower in Azerbaijan than maybe people want. But, you know, look, like part of what makes these things so valuable, right? This ecosystem, you know, that network effect, if you may, is that it's so hard to build. So, you know, in a country like Azerbaijan, they can just pick off a bunch of like the players who have little niches where they're the marketplace for this or marketplace for that. Mm-hmm. They can pick them off for really almost nothing. And kind of roll them all together. But the other thing that they have going on is that they have this massive merchant base that basically they can turn around and say, all right, you want to sell in Azerbaijan? They can drop that merchant base right in there. So like day one, like that app like already has all the merchants, and it's just a function of trying to get people in. They can start to get into peer-to-peer payments and get people on their platform. Then all of a sudden they drop the marketplace and all the merchants that they've assembled over the years in Kazakhstan. It's not impossible. It's tough. But yeah, it's a possibility in their future that is not remotely priced in adequately, in my opinion, into right. the price. Yeah. So, you know, if we're talking about all the things that could go wrong, obviously they're concentrated in Afghanistan, or I should say Afghanistan. Thank God they're not Kazakhstan. So, right. They're concentrated. Afghanistan is a potential market down the line, but it's, I'm guessing that's a little bit down their list. They're concentrated there. I mean, look, like someone in their leadership could create the wrong political enemy and, mm-hmm. you know, but like, you know, the Kazakhstan government's quite happy with them right now. They're actually like arguably the major driving force that's moving the country's informal sector into the formal sector.
Right.
Kazakhstan had a law that passed and effective as of 2020. So it's a 3-year rule from 2020, 2021, 2022, which essentially says, hey, if you're in the informal sector, you can come into the formal sector. You don't have to pay taxes for 3 years. We're not going to go after you for what's before that. Well, like Caspi literally has in their app, you can like go click a button, register your legal entity, and boom, you're set up as a legal entity in Kazakhstan, which is like, you know, countries like this, people who've tried to register businesses in the past in some of these countries, it's a bit of a complex process. You can do it all within the app, which by the way, is how they can get a lot of merchants. They can get a lot of deposits that way. And they're at the table with the Kazakhstan government, who, like I said, kind of has that Asian Geneva policy. So, how incentivized are they going to be to go after Caspi hard, which is now gaining international investors and exposure? So, the only other kind of major risk, I guess, I'd throw in there too is, you know, look, it's the rapidly changing fintech space. I kind of hate the word fintech, but they're in that space. There's an evolving digital currency situation. There's a bunch of just essentially hard to predict complexities at play. Yeah. I don't have a genius insight on that other than the observation, you know, so far Caspi and its CEO have executed flawlessly in that environment, and their ecosystem is by nature adaptable to whatever trends emerge. Correct. And we're not paying a bunch. So
yeah. Yeah. And it's not, I mean, this seems like a company that, again, the local government would want to stay friendly with, and even give them some incentives to keep growing again, because, you know, getting Kazakhstan on the digital map, and if you're trying to get people to come to your country or trying to get people to stay in your country, you've got Kaspi to kind of wave the banner and say, you know, look what we're doing on the digital front. So I don't think there's going to be any disincentives between the government and then what Kaspi's trying to do.
Yeah. And, you know, and if at some point they start trying to, you know, say, hey, you have to open up your payment platform to other parties, well, Kaspi will find a way to monetize that perfectly fine, I trust. Yep. They'll say, oh, well, maybe like the 95 basis points are going to need to come down, you know, like Alipay and all those ones in China. I think they're closer to like 60 basis points right now. Well, like, that's part of growth. They're going to be scaling up. This isn't something, you know, by that point, you know, that may not overly affect their margins in that segment by the point that's happening. And again, I think a lot of the bear points take a look at this business and almost assume the business is valued way higher than it is. And that it's just not, you don't need to try that hard to kill it at its current price, almost, if that makes sense. I mean, you should do it. It's a good exercise. But, you know, we'll see. Hit 30 times earnings, going to have to reassess a bunch of these things and how the growth's going and all that stuff.
Right, right. So I'm going to switch to an idea that's completely different than Kaspi. Kaspi is a high growth, high revenue, high free cash generating business. And this next one is not that, at least yet. So the company is Allegiance Coal, AHQ, and it trades on the Australian stock market, ASX. So again, like Kaspi, walk us through how you found this idea. What's the bull pitch here? Again, it's a coal company, so any ESG investors probably want to tune out from this point forward. But kind of take us through.
No. You know, and actually, I would beg the ESG investors to hang around because that's the whole nature of this. Is, by the way, I love this idea. It's between this and Kaspi, this is definitely a favorite of mine right now. In the ESG, I think misunderstanding of the situation is really a huge piece of what's created the opportunity. So I would beg ESG people, hang around. Hear me out on this for a second, because it's, I could actually make an ESG argument for this company. Probably stretching it a bit, but I'll do it anyway. So how I found the idea, this is another stolen idea. I should probably, find one of my own at some point this year. So I'm going to shout out a guy, his name's Sid Grover. He's about the smartest, wisest 24-year-old I've ever spoken to in my life. He makes me feel like I'm way behind as a 38-year-old. He's Canterbury Sid on Twitter. I'll spell that out, at @CANTERBURY_SID. He tweets much, but follow him just in case he does going forward, and thank me later. So he actually wrote up the idea as a microcap club application. He also interviewed the Allegiance Coal CEO, Mark Gray. If you're interested in this name after hearing about it, you can search his YouTube interview with him. Go to YouTube and type in Canterbury Lane Allegiance Coal, it'll pop up. That's really what drew my attention to the name, and Sid is who everyone can blame if the company goes bankrupt. I've given you his Twitter handle so he can build that. It's a fascinating name. I don't know where you want to start here.
I mean, let's just start with, so what's the thesis? Like, take us through, we'll go really high level and then we'll filter it down. So why coal at this point in time?
So basically, I'll walk you through kind of the initial bull pitch here. And then I can expand a bit on my thoughts on coal and ESG investing and all that. It's the basic bull pitch is this, and just fair warning, I can go on all day about this thing. I'm going to try to make this real short and sweet. So Australian listed coal producer with two pre-revenue development assets in North America. So they're really a North American company, even though they're listed in Australia. It's truly cheap in part due to ESG investor aversion to coal as a, what I would say is a general category. And I think it's silly because Allegiance produces met coal, which is used to make steel and is a non-substitutable input in that process. They're not going to be selling thermal coal, which is burned to generate electricity and contributes to global warming in a way where if we replace that with renewables or nuclear or to a lesser extent natural gas, we'd be in a better situation. So as noted, they have two assets. One's a greenfield project up in British Columbia. They're on track to be regulatorily moving that mine forward by early next year and production in 2023, assuming they complete their environmental work. But they could fail to do that. And that could be pretty much worthless up there. And either way, we'll know soon. We'll know by early 2022. There's actually a time limit on when they need to get their answers back on getting essentially approved for the environmental stuff. It's not something that can drag on 5 years. This is a potentially, by the way, very, very valuable asset, far exceeding their current market cap. But, you know, we don't need it to justify their valuation. So I'm going to call it a zero for right now. And one day you can just double the estimate or something, you know, if it comes into play. The second asset, and this is really the one to discuss, is the New Elk Mine. It's in Southeast Colorado. They bought a mine that would cost about $200 million to build greenfield for pennies on the dollar out of bankruptcy last year. They solved the issue a few other, and there are very few potential acquirers of a coal mine out of bankruptcy these days. But they solved the issue that whatever few other potential acquirers out there seemed hung up on, which was rail to transport, because they had to get it from Southeast Colorado to New Orleans, the port, in a cost-effective way. And the mine is now set to restart production any day now. Like literally, like I haven't looked this morning. Maybe there's an announcement today. Maybe it'll be next week. They're supposed to restart this month.
Got it.
So it's imminent. The after-tax NPV 8, so that's a net present value, future cash flows discount 8%. On the current New Elk Mines, 400 million Australian, roughly, versus our current market cap of 160 million. So it's 2.5 times the value. But this is where it gets fun, So that net present value is based on just the 23 megatons of immediate saleable reserves, in their mine plan versus a total resource that's estimated at 744 megatons. Wow. So let's put this another way, I kind of see them valued as a little over 3 times run rate free cash flow for the next 25 years of production on their current mine plan. And that mine plan factors in just 3% of the estimated resource. And by the way, we just said zero for the British Columbia asset. So the upside's insane. Another argument, another thing I was bringing up too here is that NPV 8%, that was based on selling our coal on, I did go through all their assumptions and they seem to be mostly pretty conservative, but it was based on selling our coal at 130 US per ton, whereas they believe they can get on spec as what would be called high vol A coking coal next year. That would increase their price assumption at current market prices to 150 per ton. That additional $20 per ton would effectively increase the net present value I just mentioned by another 65%. And those are my calculations, by the way. There's no need to bake that in, though. And you also don't need to bake in the fact that the price of coal is going nuts right now in China because you know, they have a spat ongoing with Australia where they banned their coal. And Australia, by the way, provides 65% of the seaborne met coal export volume to the world. So it's not a minor issue when you cut them off. That's the basic bull thesis around Allegiance. And I'm happy to kind of discuss, you know, if you want to discuss kind of the broader coal ESG issues, if you want there.
Yeah, well, walk me through it. Like, pretend I'm an ESG only investor that, you know, doesn't want to invest in this because I think on the surface that, you know, coal is dirty, coal is bad for the environment, green electric vehicles are the future. You know, Cathie Wood will lead us to the promised land. Just, you know, explain to me why this Allegiance Coal, as you said, is almost like a pro ESG investment.
Yeah, you know, it's actually funny you mentioned Cathie Wood, because I think someone mentioned to me, and I did look it up, but I think Caspi was actually has become an ARC name as of very recently.
Yeah, they own it.
And so that personally, that's a bear point on it, but you know, I'll get over it. You know, coal is dirty. You know, it's, you know, from a global warming standpoint, and I believe global warming is quite real. I'm not a climate change denier. It's, you know, burning coal and, you know, to produce electricity is not a particularly good way to do it. Natural gas is much cleaner and accessible. Nuclear is great if politically it's allowable. And of course, renewables are good. They're intermittent. So you got to solve the baseload problem. You know, despite, you know, the fact is that coal capacity and for thermal coal, which is used to make electricity, has been, you know, really shrinking in the West, in places like the US and Europe, while they continue to expand it in China. Those are really the countries that I think focus on if people have an issue with it. You know, the elephant in the room, obviously, when you mentioned where coal, you know, is that it's dirty, it's producing global warming. But the distinction needs to be understood between what metallurgical coal is, which is can be called met coal or coking coal, and what thermal coal is. You know, met coal, you know, is a critical input in the basic oxygen steelmaking process. That's responsible for 70% of global steel production. Mm-hmm. The other 30% is from electric arc furnaces. They're fed scrap, so it's really like a recycling operation. The steel quality is lower, so there's a lot of times where you just, you know, for your use purpose, for example, I think wind turbines frequently, you know, mm-hmm. like that you need that higher quality virgin coal or virgin steel, I should say. But you know, they both have a place over time. Electric arc furnaces have taken more and more share. Obviously, you can't go to a world that's growing where you're not producing virgin steel. You're going to run out of steel. You need a certain amount of fresh production. You know, actually, the using met coal and the way they produce, you know, virgin steel through kind of that basic oxygen steelmaking process that's responsible for 70% of production. That's also dirty, by the way. It's not good for global warming. And they're looking for other commercially viable ways to do it. For example, using hydrogen. And that's something that very well can and hopefully does emerge the next couple of decades. We're a ways away from that being commercially viable, which means right now, if you want to make new steel, you need met coal. And, you know, anyone who's opposed to met coal is effectively opposed to steel, which is a fundamental building block of modern civilization and absolutely required as countries like, you know, India continue to industrialize and develop. And there'll be a major driving, this is kind of one of the things I like about this thesis is it's kind of a play on India the next 20 years because they're gonna drive a lot of the met coal demand. You know, so what Allegiance is not mining is thermal coal. You know, technically met coal can be burned at coal plants to produce electricity. You know, the reason it's not is because it's, you know, among other things, it's low sulfur, which means it can be used to make steel, and you get a better price when you use it to make steel. One of the things that's kind of ironic to me is that actually, if you go into their business plan, they're going to be blending with coal that's currently sold and burned as thermal with an Alabama company who basically has great coal right now for met coal for selling to steel plants.
Yeah.
But it's too high sulfur. Well, the coal that they're mining in New Elk is like 0.5% sulfur. The Alabama coal is like 1.5% sulfur. Mm-hmm. You mix them together, you get them under that 1% threshold, which is what you need to kind of put it out on the met coal seaborne market. So,
so in a
sense, I would argue they're ESG because they're going to take some more thermal coal off the market, you know, but these distinctions like that required, like what I just talked for several minutes here, like no one wants to listen that long. No one wants to get into nuances. And I suspect that money managers, you know, maybe they don't understand these distinctions, or, you know, they just cynically cut the word coal out of their marketing materials for ESG purposes and don't think it's worth taking the time to try to explain the nuances and the realistic real world constraints to people.
Yeah.
So I guess what makes coal so interesting to me though, right? If you think about it, right? So met coal, if capital is going to run away from it, right? And regulations will over time kind of make it harder to add new supply, you know, greenfield mines, then we're kind of set up for a multi-decade period of high returns in capital and industry because there's not enough capital going in, there's not enough new supply going on. And it's not unlike what happened with tobacco, right? Like tobacco, they had high returns for several decades because investor aversion was keeping valuations a little bit low. Government regulation against advertising basically didn't allow new entrants to come in, and Philip Morris could cut the whole advertising budget, right?
Yep.
There are like sort of parallels with what we could see happening in met coal. I think it's going to be potentially high return on capital growth, and maybe even some reasonable growth acquisition opportunities for a company like Allegiant. Like I don't necessarily look at them as like a low growth company at all,
I mean, that's fascinating because, again, you know, this is one of those ideas that I would have never found on my own. I mean, this thing doesn't screen well. I mean, I don't even know if it has any revenue right now. I was looking at TradingView, just looking at the company, and I think it's just has like no revenue, losing $9 million a year in operating income. But again, like you would never know the true underlying value if you just tried to run a screen on something like this.
It's unscreenable. I think it's interesting too. It's with commodity businesses, it kind of reaching production inflection points. They're kind of interesting sometimes in how poorly they screen. They're just totally different from like some slow growing software business that's, you know, been, you know, whether, you know, whatever, whether it's like live chat or PGS software, like those pulling names, you know, I like, it's different. You don't really get this nice 10-year track record of, or like, oh, look what these guys are doing. It's, they have this thing, which potentially has a lot of value, and it's going to materialize really quickly, or it's not because, you know, their economics were bad. There is this opportunity, I think, with these pre-inflection point commodity businesses that don't screen well. And I think that opportunity in other areas maybe hasn't been as good because people were very interested in commodity businesses 10 years ago. And so if there's enough investor attention, they'll suss out and fully value these pre-revenue opportunities. Well, right now, I just don't see a lot of investor attention in the commodity space, particularly coal. So, and by the way, you know, a good example of this one, these types of businesses is, another business that didn't screen well a year ago was Global Atomic. That's a uranium stock I pitched for the Microcap Club LD Micro contest last year. And I got edged out for the win at the last possible second in that thing. If anyone's interested, they could try to Google Microcap Club LD Micro contest. And I have like a 10-minute pitch out there, which I think stands up a year later. that stock, you know, screened terribly and it's gone bonkers the past year. And we're still long it because it was so cheap in the first place, because you were paying a few times normalized EBITDA in early to mid 2020 for an interest in the Turkish EAF dust recycling plant, which is their one side of the business. And then you got this incredible uranium mine that was on the verge of production for free. And it, yeah. I mean, it was crazy where it was priced. It did not screen well at all. So you had to kind of stumble on it in a different way and do a lot of work, right. Which is, you know, something to be said for that.
Yep. 100%. And, you know, that's exactly why I've got, you know, you on the podcast. That's why I like to chat with you often, because you'll give me ideas that I will have never heard of, in places I wouldn't think to look. And that's kind of how I want to conclude this podcast, where, you know, are there any ideas, you know, let's say outside of Caspi, outside of Allegiance Coal, are there any names that you're researching now that, you're excited about, that you might, you know, one day maybe pull the trigger on?
You know, I have, like I said, I'm kind of, I have one I can't disclose yet in South Korea, which I'm actually very excited about. Like I said, I need to figure out where their management's been hiding. I've done a lot of scuttlebutt tracking various people down. Egypt was a big market for me last year, obviously. One of the things that attracted me to that market was, you know, obviously one, the financials are in Arabic and I feel comfortable with that. And, you know, most people don't. But another fact was Egypt was a passenger market, which basically means that, you know, when my investment pool, you know, registers there, we are registered trading and holding things in our name, not in street name. Mm-hmm. Which means it gets way harder for other microcap investors to access things through interactive brokers or, you know, sometimes Pershing and some of those other ones. So there are places that are just much more difficult to access. Part of what I'm excited about is continuing to go into some of these countries, which I know are legally annoying for other microcap investors to get into. And fishing those markets and, like I kind of said earlier, I'm still kind of stuck between which one I want to go into next. Vietnam is another one that's kind of been on my list as one to look at. I got to get comfortable with the geopolitical risk there. I don't have any other ideas that I'm currently looking at that I could throw out a podcast, but
you'll text me,
you know, I'll text you. Don't worry. Yeah. No, but it's, it's in between one or two of these little things that I see that are really interesting that I may become absorbed in the next 2 weeks, or really deep diving my next country. And, I'll definitely keep you posted on how that goes.
Awesome. Yeah. No, I mean, definitely. So again, second episode, we've had Thomas on the show. First episode, he got, I think, 350 total views. I think I was still recording that like on the floor, with a couch as my mic stand. So we've upgraded to an office. I've got a mic, I've got two monitors. Things are looking good here at the Value Hive compound. But where can people go to find you, Thomas? I know you're on Twitter, and I want to make sure that people go out and follow you, because you are one of the more underfollowed people on the platform.
No, yeah, absolutely. Yes. So they can, on Twitter, I am at PFH, P as in Paul, F as in Frank, H as in Henry Capital. So PFH Capital. And the website's www.pfhcap.com. And there's a contact form there, so people can feel free to reach out. I'm always happy to chat with people and pass on, pay forward all the, you know, investing advice I've gotten over the years, as I've developed. So.
Awesome. And then last question, I asked you this last time and I did not go back to the episode to see what your answer was, so it's going to be new to me again. If you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Oh God, I don't know what I said last time. So
even better.
I hope I don't say the same answer. See if I repeat myself. So, this is easy, man. Warren Buffett, because I turn around, I could sell the dinner to some other finance guy for millions, which is exactly what Warren would want a true value investor to do. I wouldn't have much to learn from him over dinner because he's already put every bit of knowledge he's had out in those letters over the years. And that's kind of what makes him the godfather of the industry. He's unbelievable. So I'd like to have dinner with him, but I would sell it for millions and maybe donate some of that to charity and put the rest in some obscure micro cap in some very distant country.
I love it.
Would be my game plan.
Fantastic answer. Well, Tom, thanks so much for coming on the show. I know people are going to get a real kick out of this one, and they're going to walk away with at least two new high quality ideas. And one, at least in Caspi, that I might turn around and buy because it's just very, very, very attractive. So thanks so much and good luck with the rest of this year. And we'll do it again next year.
Absolutely, man. Anytime.